infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's have some tunes to start this night off right.
All right.
Well, it looks like we made it through the apocalypse, and we didn't even have to kill any zombies. So here we are, the week after Doomsday, and we're on the air. And I guess Harold Camping, the man we talked about last week who made this world phenomenon happen with this everybody looking at Doomsday and chuckling, most people, and other people very confused, and other people who I don't even want to talk about them. Anyways, he has moved on, and he has made another prediction for October 21st, so we'll have to make sure we check that out. And, of course, the week after the 21st, we'll be on here talking about how it didn't happen then, too. Anyway, moving on to Earth and environment news this week in science. Deep ocean jets drive the Atlantic weather. Regular weather patterns in the tropical Atlantic are driven by deep ocean currents, not the winds and other atmospheric factors that cause El Niño and similar cycles. An international research team now finds evidence that 4.5-year cycles in temperature, precipitation, and winds are driven by deep jets in equatorial waters that carry energy upward. These fast-paced currents appear to originate, quote, in the abyss, perhaps as deep as several thousand meters, unquote, the researchers reported online May 19th in Nature and very independently of the seasons. Well, the Arctic ice is still thinning. Year-old ice floating on the Beaufort Sea is 20 to 30 centimeters thinner this year than in the last two, new aircraft and satellite-based analysis have found. On May 6th, researchers from the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research in Bremerhaven, Germany, completed a six-week stint flying the polar skies from Alaska to Norway with a host of sensors. An electromagnetic ice thickness gauge towed 15 meters above the sea surface found that Beaufort ice north of Alaska and Canada was 1.4 meters thick. That's 18% thinner than in 2009, meaning the ice probably will not survive this coming summer, concludes AWI's Stefan Hendricks. Kind of bad news going on there. And core meltdown. Well, even the Earth's inner iron heart can be coaxed to melt. A team of scientists based in England, India, and the United States has calculated how heat flows around the boundary between the innermost core, which is solid iron, and the outer core, which is liquid. The simulation suggests that heat transferred from the shallower in the Earth can sometimes get all the way down to the inner core, melting it in places. The work, which appears in the May 19th issue of Nature, helps explain the existence of a long puzzling layer 150 kilometers above the inner core boundary and sheds light on how the fluid outer core generates Earth's magnetic field. So you can check both of those out, and they're both in Nature. Well, one is 1 week and one is the next week, May 6th and May 19th respectively. And aerial microbes can trigger precipitation. Germy with the chance of hail? Well, bacteria often leave their host feeling under the weather. And even when the host are high-altitude parcels of air, microbes can be a source of inclement conditions, a Montana research team has found. Cloud-borne bacteria might even pose climate threats by boosting the production of a greenhouse gas, another team proposes. Both groups reported their findings May 24th at the American Society for Microbiology meeting in New Orleans. These data add to a growing body of evidence that biological organisms are affecting clouds, notes Anthony Prenny of Colorado State University in Fort Collins, an atmospheric scientist who did not participate in the studies. Right now, he cautions, quote, we still don't know on a global scale how important these processes are, unquote. But a research into microbial impacts on weather and climate is really heating up, he adds. So, quote, within a few years, I think we're going to have a much better handle on it, unquote. Now, Alexander Machaud's new research was triggered by a June storm that pummeled Montana State University's campus in Bozeman last year with golf ball-sized and larger hailstones. The microbial ecologist normally studies subglacial aquatic environments in Antarctica, but after saving 27 of the hailstones, he says, quote, I suddenly realized that no one had really ever thought about studying hailstones in layered sense for biology. So his team dissected the icy balls along with hundreds of smaller ones collected during a July hailstorm south of campus. Machaud now reports finding germs throughout, with the highest concentrations by far, some 1,000 cells per milliliter of meltwater in the hailstone's cores. Since at least the 1980s, scientists have argued that some share of clouds and their precipitation likely traces to microbes. Their reasoning is that strong winds can loft germs many kilometers into the sky, and since the 1970s, agricultural scientists have recognized that certain compounds made by microbes serve as efficient water magnets around which ice crystals can form at relatively high temperatures, occasionally leading to frost devastation of crops. In 2008, Brent Christner of Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge and his colleagues reported isolating ice nucleating bacteria from rain and snow. A year later, Prenny's group found microbes associated with at least a third of the cloud ice crystals they sampled at an altitude of 8 kilometers. Quote, but finding ice nucleating bacteria in snow or hail is very different from saying they were responsible for the ice, says Noah Firer of the University of Colorado at Boulder. I say that, he admits, even though as a microbiologist I'd love to believe that bacteria control weather. Pure water molecules won't freeze in air at temperatures above about negative 40 degrees Celsius, Christner notes. Add tiny motes of mineral dust or clay and water droplets may coalesce around them or nucleate at perhaps negative 15 degrees. But certain bacteria can catalyze ice nucleation at even negative 2 degrees. He reported this at the meeting in New Orleans. Through chemical techniques, Michaud's group determined that the ice nucleation in their hail occurred around negative 11.5 degrees in the June hailstones and at roughly negative 8.5 degrees for the July stones. Michaud's data on the role of microbes in precipitation, quote, is pretty strong evidence, unquote, Prenny says. Now, also at the meeting, Pierre Amato of Clermont University in Clermont-Ferrand, France, reported biological activity in materials sampled from a cloud at an altitude of 1,500 meters. The air hosted many organic pollutants, including formaldehyde, acetate, and oxalate. Now, sunlight can break these down to carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas, something Amato's group confirmed in the lab. But sunlight didn't fully degrade some organics unless microbes were also present. Moreover, certain cloud-borne bacteria the French team identified at least 17 types degraded organic pollutants to carbon dioxide at least as efficiently as the sun did. Amato's team reported these findings online February 9th in Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics Discussions. Now, this microbial transformation of pollutants to carbon dioxide occurs even in darkness. Amato has calculated the total nighttime microbial production of carbon dioxide in clouds and pegs it, quote, on the order of 1 million tons per year, unquote. Though not a huge sum equal to the carbon dioxide from perhaps 180,000 cars per year, but he cautions that this amount could increase based on airborne pollutant levels, temperatures, and microbial populations. And now let's take a look at molecules, matter, and energy news. Devices that use the spin property of electrons to store and process information are one step closer to reality thanks to a new MRI technique with a resolution tens of thousands times better than an MRI brain scan. Researchers at Harvard University and Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics can now watch many electrons spin at the same time and change the spin of a single electron without disturbing its neighbor. The device was tested on a piece of diamond but could be used to monitor many different kinds of materials as reported in Nature Physics on May 15th. And wrinklons, a new species of wrinkle, yes, I said wrinkle, from heavy curtains to layers of carbon only two atoms thick. Sheets attached at one end tend to bunch up in the same way. The shape such a thin layer will take as it is compressed can be predicted by a mathematical formula, says an international team of physicists. A paper to appear in an upcoming Physical Review Letters describes how to calculate stretching energy in units called wrinklons and how to smooth out imperfections with subtle tugs. Hard as diamonds? Well, almost. Nothing is harder than a diamond, but a dozen arrangements of carbon that are nearly as hard have been predicted by a new computer simulation. Material scientists at Stony Brook University in New York developed an algorithm that searches for the weakest bonds in a material and optimizes its structure to improve stability. When applied to existing materials, the simulations tend to agree with measurements of hardness, as described in a paper posted May 9th at arxiv.com. neutrinos.org. And neutrinos for peace? Well, detectors originally designed to spot particles from space are now monitoring particles spilling out of a nuclear power plant in California. In a paper posted May 11th on arxiv.org, also, researchers described the installation and operation of the latest prototype, a device made of water that detects antineutrinos created by nuclear fission and could help the International Atomic Energy Agency guard against the theft of nuclear materials. The first underground prototypes of plastic were able to measure the power level of the plant and spot the removal of plutonium, a material that could be used to make nuclear bombs. And now, how about time for a little music break? And in atoms and cosmos news, planetary scientists have found for the first time documented in detail the effects of a Saturnian storm on the planet's atmosphere. Combining data from satellites and ground-based telescopes, an international team of researchers found that within a month of the onset of a storm last December, the disturbance had penetrated hundreds of kilometers into Saturn's stratosphere, altering temperature, winds, and composition over an entire hemisphere. The storm also created brilliant beacons of infrared light and created a new cold vortex in the middle of the disturbance, the team reported online May 19th in Science. And in an atmospheric smash, a once-a-decade cosmic collision was heard halfway around the world, scientists have found. In October 2009, a small asteroid entered the atmosphere over Indonesia and disintegrated spectacularly. Scientists detected the sound waves that the fireball sent reverberating through the atmosphere as far away as Bolivia, say Elizabeth Silber of the University of Western Ontario and her colleagues. The blast was one of the most energetic ever recorded. The researchers reported this in a paper to appear in an upcoming issue of Geophysical Research Letters. And astronomers have found direct evidence that galaxy mergers, although initially triggering strong star formation and black hole growth, ultimately bring both processes to a halt. The findings are based on some of the first observations of molecular gas, the raw material for making stars, rushing out of the centers of several galaxies. Most of the galaxies house black holes and had been involved in violent mergers. The outflows, powered by stellar winds or radiation associated with black holes, are strong enough to expel the gas in an astronomically brief 100 million years or less, stopping star formation, an international team reported in the May 20th issue of Astrophysical Journal Letters. And bathtubs and black holes? Boy, black holes are really popular today. Watching water drain from a bathtub is a lot safer than watching photons orbit just outside a rotating black hole, of course, but the result could be just as instructive. A new mathematical analysis details how sound waves that orbit within the draining fluid, either in the direction of the fluid's rotation or against it, resemble the path of photons circling a spinning black hole. Scientists first suggested 3 decades ago that water going down a drain might be a good analog for a spinning black hole, but this new study strengthens the model's validity, and an international team of researchers reported this in an article posted at arxiv.org on May 10th. And investigating Iapetus? Well, one long-ago wallet may explain 2 current puzzles about Saturn's moon, Iapetus, its slow rotation, and equatorial ridge. Planetary scientists suggest that early in the moon's history, Iapetus was struck by another body. Some of the debris kicked up by the impact formed a ring around Iapetus, and while debris further out formed a small satellite. The satellite rapidly pushed the ring onto the surface of Iapetus, forming the ridge. And as the satellite migrated outwards, its gravitational interactions with Iapetus slowed the moon's spin. Hal Levison and his colleagues at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, described their simulation in an upcoming Icarus. And Japan plans solar panels for all new buildings. The plan, expected to be unveiled at the upcoming G8 summit in France, aims to show Japan's resolve to encourage technological innovation and promote the wider use of renewable energy, the Nikkei Daily said. Japan has reeled from the March 11th earthquake and tsunami and the nuclear crisis they triggered as it battles to stabilize the crippled Fukushima Daiichi atomic power plant. And on Thursday, the first of the 2-day summit in Deauville, France, Prime Minister Naoto Kan is expected to announce Japan's intention to continue operating nuclear plants after confirming their safety, the Nikkei said without citing sources. But he is also expected to unveil a plan to step up efforts to push renewable energy and energy conservation. Kan says that the installation of solar panels would help Japan realize such goals, the Nikkei said. He hopes that technological innovation will drastically bring down cost of solar power generation and thereby make the use of renewable energy more widespread, it said. And when you think of physics, you don't automatically think of alligators, but when males attract attention by quivering their spiky backs underwater, they create Faraday waves, researchers reported May 23rd in Seattle at a meeting of the Acoustical Society of America. These sophisticated patterns are usually seen only in man-made devices. Faraday waves haven't really been seen in nature before, says John Allen, acoustician at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, who was not involved with the research. Now, when a male alligator craves company, He issues a sound from his lungs that is too low to be heard. This infrasound causes him to vibrate violently and whips the water onto his back in a froth of waves and leaping fountains. Acoustician R. Glenn Holt of Boston University saw a video of this water dance, quote-unquote, and was reminded of physicist Michael Faraday. In 1831, Faraday discovered that liquid above a vibrating object sometimes forms surface waves that move up and down at half the speed of the vibrations. In search of Faraday waves, Boston University undergraduate Peter Moriarty traveled to Gatorama, a roadside attraction where? In Palmdale, Florida, of course. The home to, you know, lots of alligators. Now, he played alligator calls to a gator named Mr. Chicken and recorded the enthusiastic response, an 18 to 20 hertz rumble. Hidden in the sound was the telltale sign of a Faraday wave, another sound at half the vibrational frequency, 9 to 10 hertz. Surface waves with this frequency should have a wavelength of about 3 centimeters, which agrees with the measurements made from photos of amorous alligators. 3 centimeters is also almost exactly one-third the distance between the rough protrusions or scutes on the creature's back. Quote, "We think that the shape of their scutes helps them create these waves," says Moriarty. Now, the shapes of some backs may make better waves for signaling mates, he speculates, possibly a kind of sexual selection. How rough do alligators like it? Well, Moriarty has built his own mock alligator back just to find out. And I will definitely be putting that on my alert because I want to see if he does a video on it. That'll be pretty cool. And here's a little teeny bit of controversy going on regarding the environment, science, and the public. And NRC is saying that it's time to put a price on carbon. Quote, "It is imprudent to delay actions that at least begin the process of substantially reducing emissions of greenhouse gases," they mean, unquote, according to a May 12th report by the National Research Council. It didn't get a lot of press play in the past week, but perhaps it's because it's 144 pages long, and they didn't say anything that readers might not have expected this august body to have proclaimed years ago. But that shouldn't diminish the significance of this report, so you can look it up. Go to the National Research Council and see what you think about it. Geographic profiling fights disease will widely used to snare serial criminals. A forensic method is finding application in epidemiology. A widely used criminology technique called geographic profiling helps investigators narrow a search by pinpointing high-priority targets among thousands of potential locations. In an upcoming International Journal of Health Geographics, researchers demonstrated the technique's usefulness by identifying the sources of recent malaria outbreak in Cairo and reconstructing an infamous cholera outbreak in Victorian London. Applying the technique to infectious diseases could help focus interventions, perhaps preventing the spread of disease while saving time and money. "I think this has a lot of promise," quote-unquote, says disease ecologist Richard Ostfield of the Carey Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York. Quote, "It's a very interesting application of a criminological tool to epidemiology," unquote. Now, when hunting criminals, geographic profiling uses the sites of connected crimes to figure out where a criminal might live. Pioneered by criminologist Kim Rossmo, a former Vancouver police officer now at Texas State University San Marcos, the method is based on a criminal's tendency to take a Goldilocks-like approach when selecting where to commit a crime, a location that's not too close to home, not too far, but just right. Rossmo, a co-author of the new study, developed an algorithm that incorporates this notion in two parts. The crime is less likely to be committed in the criminal's buffer zone, which is the immediate vicinity of his or her home or work, because detection is riskier and the opportunities may be few, and the likelihood of a crime site decays with distance because travel requires time, effort, and or money. "I'm based in London," quote-unquote, says study co-author Stephen Lecomber of Queen Mary University of London. So I am not going to pop up to Inverness, which is in the far reaches of Scotland, to murder someone, but equally I don't want to commit crimes on my own doorstep, quote-unquote. Now, the math behind geographic profiling also incorporates the idea that all distances are not created equal. Highways are easier to traverse than a congested downtown. All these measures then generate a map of places the offender is likely to live, which is overlaid on a map of a search area. Unlike geospatial techniques that designate a central point from which a search radiates equally outward, geographic profiling pinpoints highly probable locations, even if they are at opposite ends of the search area. Now, Lacomber and his colleagues applied geographic profiling to a recent malaria outbreak in Cairo, as we just stated, and of the 59 water bodies where mosquito larvae are found, only 8 contained those species that are the most dangerous carriers of the disease. Now, knowing only the locations of the outbreak's 139 malaria cases, geographic profiling correctly put 6 of these 8 sites in the most infectious 2% of the 59. I have to say it impressed us, says Lacomber. We thought it would work, but it was a bit stunning. Now, the team also used the technique on the 1854 London cholera outbreak, from which Dr. John Snow famously created a map of cholera deaths. This had led Snow to the Broad Street pump as a source of the disease and launched the modern field of epidemiology. Now, based on 321 deaths, geographic profiling also ranked the Broad Street pump as the most likely origin of the outbreak, the researchers had reported. Now, in some instances, such as diseases that have secondary outbreaks, geographic profiling might not work as well, says Ostfeld, but it could help yield more accurate maps for ecological questions, he says, such as how species ranges might respond to climate change. Researchers are already using the method to study how sharks hunt and the movement of bats and bees. It's kind of a poetic justice, says Ostfeld. Molecular biology in particular has served as a tremendous boon to criminology methods, unquote. DNA profiling, for example, arose from investigations of evolution and the genetics of disease. It's nice to see a transfer in both directions, Ostfeld says, from biology to criminalistics and back. And the ocean and carbon dioxide we just mentioned in two other stories. Well, here's something with both of them in it. Efforts to remove climate warming carbon dioxide from Earth's atmosphere appear to be getting a helping hand from a surprising source, the iron in meltwater from Antarctic icebergs. That's kind of interesting. Now, the icebergs calving off of Antarctica are shedding substantial iron, the equivalent of a growth-boosting vitamin, of course, into waters starved of the mineral. A new set of studies demonstrates this iron is fertilizing the growth of microscopic plants and algae, transforming the waters adjacent to ice floes into teeming communities of everything from tiny shrimp-like krill to fish, birds, and sometimes even mammals. To grow, these plants and animals use carbon drawn into the water from carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Some share of this carbon will eventually be excreted as waste that fall into the ocean floor, essentially removing it as a near-term climate risk. Icebergs should be considered by climate modelers because the more icebergs that develop from the breakup of glaciers, the more carbon dioxide you'll draw out of the atmosphere, says Ken Smith of the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in Moss Landing, California. Now, Smith and his colleagues first fingered icebergs as hotspots of biological and chemical activity in a 2007 study published in Science. New data from Antarctic cruises in 2008 and 2009 by Smith and other scientists from 9 research institutions now appear as 20 papers in the June Deep Sea Research Part 2. Now, researchers refer to icebergs' carbon removal as an export, and the amount of carbon being exported near icebergs as twice as high as in areas away from them, Smith says. Counterbalancing icebergs' carbon removal is that no one views the sea level rise accompanying massive ice melting as a good thing. The rate of iceberg calving and ice loss in recent years has increased there as elsewhere in response to a warming of Earth's atmosphere. Prior to the new studies, we didn't know the nature of the biological communities associated with icebergs, and we certainly didn't know their direct relationship relationship to carbon exports, says chemist Timothy Shaw of the University of South Carolina in Columbia, who co-authored several of the new reports. One surprise is that the proliferation of phytoplankton, which are tiny plants at the base of the marine food chain, that were witnessed in the waters around ice floes, could only account for about half of the increased carbon export we measured, Shaw says. His team now attributes the other half to changes in the chemistry of iron and carbon used by phytoplankton living next to and under the icebergs. Benjamin Twining of the Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences in West Booth Bay Harbor, Maine, points to another big surprise. Icebergs' iron enrichment of southern waters could vary by a factor of 100 from one iceberg to another, or even along walls of a given berg. Now, this patchy enrichment reflects differences in chemical reactions triggered by various organisms and to the unexpectedly complicated turbulence associated with water melting from the flows. And now I think it's about time for a little bit of music.
Never feared for anything, never shame, but never free. A life that healed the broken heart with all that it gave. Lived a life so endlessly, saw beyond what others see. I tried to heal your broken heart with all that I could. Will you stay? Will you stay away forever? How do I live without the ones I love? Time still turns the pages of the book, it's burned. Home. Foolish lies of growing old. It seems we're so invincible. The truth is so cold. A final song, a last request. A perfect chapter laid to rest. Now and then I try to find a place in my mind where you can stay. You can stay away forever. So
Well, we had an awful lot of attention on earthquakes and geo changes, massive tornadoes and superstorms that have been going on here in America, but also in the Andes, which people living on the west side of the Andes generally expect large earthquakes, like the magnitude 8.8 quake that struck last year off the coast of Chile, but those farther inland are also at risk, a new study suggests. Global positioning data show that the ground east of the central Andes, such as in eastern Bolivia, moves far less than the west and hence might be building up stress. Earthquakes as large as magnitude 8.7 to 8.9, not 7.5 as previously thought, could thus strike where 2 million people live. Researchers led by Benjamin Brooks of the University of Hawaii at Manoa reported this finding online May 8th in Nature Geoscience. And, oh, Athens! Almost forgot about this one. You could take a cruise to Greece and you'll likely dock at Piraeus, which is now a peninsula, but was once an island, a new research suggests. Now, in the first century, the Greek historian Strabo wrote that the Athenian port was once surrounded by water, and now French and Greek geologists have discovered he was right. By scrutinizing sediments drilled nearby, the scientists found that rising sea levels cut off Piraeus from the mainland between 4850 and 3450 BCE, and again between 2850 and 1550 BCE. Now, this work appeared online in the May 4th issue of Geology. And gambling with your heart and your lungs? Well, that doesn't sound very good. Listen to this. Breathing is a risky bet in casinos that allow smoking. A team of researchers compared air pollution inside 66 casinos that allowed smoking with that in 3 casinos that imposed a smoking ban. In smoke-free casinos, the air was no more polluted than outdoors, typically about 3 to 4 micrograms of fine particulates per cubic meter of air. In smoking casinos, secondhand smoke boosted particulate pollution accounts to 50 micrograms per cubic meter. One establishment had 4 times that much. Smoky air in roughly half the casinos, quote, exceeded a level known to produce cardiovascular morbidity in non-smokers after less than 2 hours, posing acute health risks. The researchers reported this in the May issue of Environmental Research. Think about the people who work there. Even if they don't smoke, they're getting the deficit from the people who do. And they're there all day or night. And early dioxin exposure impairs sperm quality. Now, here's another effect of the environment on human biology. Exposure to relatively low levels of dioxins in the womb and during infancy can induce developmental changes in boys that will permanently diminish sperm quality, a new study finds. An international team of researchers studied 97 Italian men, including 39 whose mothers have been exposed to a major industrial release of dioxins in 1976. Sperm quality was comparable among all of the men except those whose moms had lived near the dioxin accident and breastfed their babies. That exposed group of men have half the normal sperm count and a 20% reduction in sperm motility, the scientists reported in the May Environmental Health Perspectives. And if that isn't bad enough with what we do to our environment and how it affects us adversely, health-wise, pesticides are now tied to lower IQs in children. Children exposed in the womb to substantial levels of neurotoxic pesticides have somewhat lower IQs by the time they enter school than do kids with virtually no exposure. A trio of studies screened women for compounds in blood or urine that mark exposure to organophosphate pesticides such as chlorpyrifos, diazinon, or melatonin. Now, these bug killers, which can cross the human placenta, work by inhibiting brain signaling compounds. Although the pesticide's residential use was phased out in 2000, spraying on farm fields still remains legal. 3 new studies began in the late 1990s and followed children through age 7. Pesticide exposures stem from farm work in more than 300 low-income Mexican-American families in California, researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, and their colleagues have reported. In 2 comparably sized New York City populations, exposures likely traced to bug spraying of homes or eating treated produce. Now, among the California families, the average IQ for the 20% of children with the highest prenatal organophosphate exposure was 7 points lower compared with the least exposed group. A Columbia University study followed low-income Black and Hispanic families, and here, each additional 4.6 picrograms of chlorpyrifos per gram of blood in a woman during her pregnancy correlated with a drop of 1.4% in her youngster's IQ and a 2.8% in a measure of the child's working memory. Findings from a more diverse group of New York City families recruited by the Mount Sinai School of Medicine point to genetics as a major determinant of risk from pesticide exposure. Children who showed the biggest cognitive impacts tended to have mothers carrying a gene variant for a slow-acting version of the enzyme that breaks down organophosphates. This variant is present in roughly one-third of all Americans, observed study leader Stephanie Engel, now at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Another observation from her study: children exhibited bigger IQ deficits if they came from homes that had been treated with organophosphates while their moms were pregnant, even if the woman's urine at the time wasn't higher in breakdown products than that of parents whose kids had more normal cognitive scores. Organophosphate breakdown products aren't toxic, just a putative marker of exposure to the toxic parent pesticide, Engel notes. So the presence of organophosphate breakdown products in mothers of the less affected kids may reflect the mother's exposure primarily to breakdown products, not the parent organophosphates. Findings from all three studies are appearing online in the April 21st issue of Environmental Health Perspective, so you can check that out. And here's a little bit more. Quote, there was an amazing degree of consistency in the findings across all three studies, unquote, notes Bruce Lamphere of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. And that's concerning, he says, because a drop of 7 IQ points is a big deal. In fact, half of 7 IQ points would be a big deal, especially when you see this across a population. Each IQ point drop will add up to extra cost in lost earnings over an individual's lifetime, he says, and even potentially to higher education and other costs to deal with behavioral and learning problems that may occur during childhood. And in other biology news, well, body and the brain, the anti-leukemia drug alemtuzumab, or also known as Campeth, can lessen the risk of immune rejection in some people receiving a kidney transplant, a new study finds. But the study, published in the May 19th New England Journal of Medicine, suggests that the drug doesn't improve prospects for the patients most prone to rejecting a transplant. Researchers at several U.S. medical facilities enrolled 139 such high-risk patients and 335 low-risk patients to get either alemtuzumab or standard drugs after a kidney transplant. 3 years later, 8 of low-risk recipients getting alemtuzumab and 70% of medication had survived with no rejection. Among the high-risk group, those percentages were 76 and 70, a difference that could be due to chance, they think. And so you can look that up, and it was in the May 19th issue of New England Journal of Medicine. And drugs could limit an HIV transfer, which is interesting news. By taking drugs to suppress HIV, an infected person in a heterosexual relationship can greatly limit the risk of infecting his or her partner. Drug therapy suppresses the virus, boosts T cells, and has long been assumed to protect against HIV transmission. An international team enrolled 1,763 couples in which one person was HIV positive. In half, that partner received a preventative cocktail of 3 drugs. In the other couples, the HIV positive partner started on drugs only if CD4 T cell counts dropped. Of 28 new partner-to-partner infections since 2007, all but one arose in couples who hadn't started on the drugs preventatively. The National Institutes of Health released the findings on May 12th. And coffee versus prostate cancer? Well, that's kind of an unusual Bit of information here. Gulping down a lot of coffee, though, might provide men with an edge against dangerous prostate cancers, researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health reported May 17th in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. They monitored nearly 50,000 men in a large medical study from 1986 to 2006. More than 5,000 developed prostate cancer in that time, 642 with lethal cases. Compared to coffee abstainers, men quaffing 6 or more cups a day. Wow, 6 or more cups a day? Do I do that? That's a lot of coffee. Were slightly less likely to develop any advanced prostate cancer and were considerably less prone to getting a lethal case. 1 to 3 cups a day decreased the risk of such dangerous prostate cancers slightly. Transplant protectors, well, immune cells that tone down their more excitable fellow soldiers might prevent immune rejection that can jeopardize organ transplants, three studies in the May 18th Science Translational Medicine showed. Researchers harness regulatory T cells, or TREGs, which inhibit inflammation and calm other immune reactions. Now, boosting supplies of TREGs in mice limited the animal's rejection of transplanted skin tissue in 2 different studies. In a 3rd, additional TREGs given to mice thwarted a dangerous condition called graft versus host disease, in which immune cells in donor tissues attack their new host. These studies by an international team of scientists may advance the use of TREGs in organ transplants and against autoimmune diseases. And your gut microbes are what you eat. Your diet strongly influences intestinal bacteria populations. Now, on the Serengeti Plain, gut bacteria reveal who's been eating grass and who's been sampling the gazelle. What a mammal eats seems to determine the microbial species that live in its intestines and what jobs those microbes take on, an international team of researchers reported May 20th in Science. The nutrients inside meat and veggies predictably influence different communities of friendly bacteria that inhabit both vegetarian and meat-eating species, a group says. Now, this kind of work is foundational, says Martin Blaser, a microbiologist at New York University who was not involved with the study. Quote, it helps to define the macro rules that govern these things. Now, in the study, researchers picked microbes from the feces of 33 mammal species and took a close look at the genes those bugs carried. Now, of 1,500 pieces of genes that seem to code for enzymes, 495 were associated with microbes belonging to either herbivores, like the hapless gazelle, or carnivores, such as the lion. Herbivore and carnivore microbes may be different, but they also seem to have different jobs that are determined by diet, says co-author Jeffrey Gordon, a systems biologist at Washington University in St. Louis. Carnivores' microbes carry genes seemingly suited to breaking down the abundant amino acids in the diets of their hosts. Well, that makes sense. Herbivores' bacteria, on the other hand, appear to be better at building new amino acids from scratch. The pattern seemed to make sense given the lion's protein-rich and the gazelle's protein-poor diet, suggests co-author Brian McGue, also at Washington University. And for herbivores, those bugs need to make the amino acids they need for life, he says. Now, proteins and other nutrients also hold sway over the gut bacteria with any given species, Gordon adds. In a separate study appearing online May 19th in Science, he and his colleagues took 10 species of intestinal bacteria from humans and put them into mice. By precisely tweaking the ratios of nutrients present in the mice's diet, the team could predict 60% of the changes to the friendly microbes that followed. Such microbial sculpting may help provide tools for improving human health, Gordon says. At a time when nutrition represents a global health problem, he says, how do we make appropriate and informed and more helpful recommendations for what we should eat? Still, it's not clear what communities of bacteria down to different strains of the same species will do best for specific clinical outcomes, says David Relman, an infectious disease researcher at Stanford University. Though general rules like those outlined in the study may help scientists as they dig deeper, he says, there are all sorts of details we're glossing over by looking at poop samples. What a great quote to have in, any science digest. Poop samples. Yeah, well, How else are you supposed to know what's going on inside people's bodies, right? What goes in has to come out. And that brings us to the end, speaking of endings, of Savage Science Radio this week. I'd like to thank Nick Palucco for the great show graphics and Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for the fantastic intro that I use every week. Waleed Al-Haddad, who helps me find stories to bring to you, and my wonderful and magical executive producer, Todd Sheets. Without him, the show would really be a mess, you know, more than normal. Anyway, I hope you guys have a great week, and keep your powder in your pants dry, and happy trails until we meet again.
Believe that just saying it is going to do it, you know. I mean, yeah. I still believe in the fact that love is what we all need.
And it was for love. It was for love and bloody peace again, you know. It was a fabulous time.